What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, it's Pauline Maranin again here. And on this podcast, we are referring to Chapter 3 of the book, What Does Law Mean, Mumu? An Introduction to the Law for Young People. Chapter 3 dealt with the heading for Chapter 3 was, as you will know if you've read the book or are reading it, Mumu talks to her band of learners about the law and democracy. And I think in the course of discussing universal suffrage, which is the way we describe everybody who's eligible, if the age of voting is 18, that everybody who's eligible in the country has the right to vote. And in the course of that discussion, we were talking about how potential candidates go out, how they form political parties, how they go out and canvass, having set up their manifesto, which is what they propose to run on, and how they would propose to form a government and what they would do in the running of our countries. I think, after all the heavy going and the difficult concepts we were discussing, one of the learners said, well, what's so special about votes anyway? And in addition to a round of horror, I think, expressed by Nova as to how that question could be asked, Mumu decided then to divert the minds onto thinking about countries where votes and having the right to vote was a very rare and precious step in their history, and how so many people had to give their lives in order to have a right to vote, and the tyrannies of countries where that right was taken away from people, or even in our own current times, where some presidents get in by virtue of a vote, but then decide to bring in a law which does away with the need to have those votes and says that they will be in office as president for what seems like ever. So it's important to continuously bear in mind the importance of the right to vote, the right for self-determination, as it's called, and the right for people to have a say in the running of their country. Now, some people might say that all sounds very lofty and hypothetical and theoretical, but if you look into our recent past, you can see all of the suffering and the inequalities that were allowed to prevail for a very long time. We're not looking at history in through a long distance microscope, we're talking about recent times. And in the course of referring to this to the band of learners, I referred to the fact of, if you looked at countries like Zimbabwe or South Africa, after they had got the right, after all the black people there and all the people of all races had the right to vote, how you would see the news footage of those momentous occasions with camera crews showing people in long lines standing, queuing from early morn to register their vote, and the pride and the determination they took in that moment, that breakthrough. As the podcast is supposed to be a little bit more to do with food for thought, perhaps I could elaborate on some of my close-hand experiences of that, in that I made a trip to South Africa in 2015, and I travelled to Robben Island. You may have heard of that, because in Chapter 3 we refer to Nelson Mandela, a very famous man who spent something like 27 years in prison because of his taking a stand to fight for equality, to fight for the right for black people in South Africa to have a vote. Now, you might say that's very odd. And how did that arise? Well, there was an Afrikaans government in power that had brought in a system, a way of organising society known as apartheid. It's a policy, a process, a system that was applied. And what it basically means is a decision to segregate, to separate society on grounds of race. It can be used in a wider context, that word. But apartheid meant that black people, coloured people and white people were subject to different rights and different rules. In the defence forces in South Africa, when the pay packets came in, there were brown envelopes for the black people as opposed to white envelopes. people in the Defence Forces who were not white. There were benches outside courthouses. I saw them with my own eyes, with written on the bench was "whites only," and another bench on the other side of the door of one particular courthouse I passed saying "coloureds only." And I don't know where the black people were supposed to sit in that particular street. So I went to visit Robben Island, which was this island. A lot of countries have those for prisons set apart from the mainland, obviously to contain the prisoners, high security prisons. And I visited Robben Island on one day. You take a ferry out there, very choppy seas, so you can understand how difficult it would be to escape from there. Like the famous Alcatraz in America, surrounded by water. I heard that one person had actually escaped, a prisoner who had been put there, a black man, because he had acquired his own cattle. Stories are hard to believe, but it's important to bear in mind that all of this was happening in the, let's go to a date which you could relate to, the 1970s, the 1980s and the 1990s. When your parents would have been alive and even some of them substantially grown up at school like you are now. So at that time, Robben Island was used as a place to put people who had been found guilty of political crimes. So they were protesters, taken certain acts of sabotage to show their dissatisfaction with the apartheid regime in their effort to bring about equality for all. And when we arrived there, there was a little coach then on the shoreline of the harbour when you came in that brought you into a further yard that had guides waiting to take you from there. So then when you went on the little bus, you had a guide telling you about the prison and the area generally. And when you went into the inner sanctum, there was an individual guide. There were two coaches on my trip, and I was lucky to have my guide of the prison, who was a member of the staff who had actually served time in the prison while Mandela was there, though he was a much younger man. He had committed some act of sabotage or revolt, and he was very young when he was brought there. His name is Derek Bosson, and he was a most remarkable man who spoke in, I can only describe it as a beguiling and indefinable way of speaking. He had was soft-spoken with clear diction, precision in his language. He spoke slowly. He talked a lot about sharing and learning. And I think I mentioned to you that I would at some stage disclose where the word "the learners" had come from. Well, I'll tell you shortly how Derek Bosson used the expression "the learners." But he brought us to see Mandela's cell. Maybe a lot of people have had this experience. Tiny little cell, dimly lit with a window up very high, like any of the dreadful cells you would see in many films and books and paintings about such a tiny little table, more or less like a stool. And that was where he was put. Derek Bosson showed us the room. We went into the room where we had his talk, and he told us that between 40 and 60 men would have been in there. One of the additional cruelties was that they slept on the floor. He showed us the sisal, kind of ropey material mat, and one very thin blanket, which they weren't given immediately. They had to build up credits for that. They were put in short trousers, which were made of a rough Hessian type material with no underwear, no socks, and no sandals, divided into categories of whites, Indians, Asians, coloured and black people. And they were mixed in, the political prisoners were mixed in with some pretty severe prisoners, people who had been found guilty of rape and murder. So they were mixed with other real criminals, if you like. And that was to add to their sense of intimidation and fear. When they arrived there, most of the young people who would have been protesting for black emancipation and equality were illiterate. They couldn't read or write because they hadn't been given an education. And one of the many campaigns that Mandela ran when he was there was to try to get books brought in. And they weren't allowed books. and also all of the different five, some people argue at seven different tribes in South Africa, would have their own dialect, their own language. And when they arrived, the guards spoke to them in Afrikaans, which is the language they would speak, and referred to the prisoners only by their number. They were never given their name. So they had to very quickly learn that number because they would be beaten if they didn't respond when their number was called out. And at that stage, they tried to use pieces of charcoal, which Mandela did, to encourage them to try and write, and those who could read and write to teach, to spread, to share and learn, which was the motto. And they wrote with charcoal on old pieces of hessian. He told us that the light bulb in this large room for 40 to 60 men would sleep on the floor, cramped together. 40-watt bulbs, so they would have very little lighting. Their eyesight was very bad because what they were doing was breaking up rocks on that island. That was what they did all day, hard labour, with very raw implements. So they had to hammer with these, what just looked like stones on stones, to break up the stone, and the lime dust got in their eyes and caused dreadful respiratory difficulties as well, as you can imagine. They were not allowed to write out, and I think I mentioned in the context of Jolyon Jackson's father, who had been taken prisoner in the Second World War and spent over 6 years, 6.5 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, where we referred to them being just allowed to write so many words on a little card. I had heard that story in 1994 from Jolyon Jackson's mother, Charmian, and I later was to encounter the same thing in Robben Island when I was told that they were only allowed to write very, very rarely, and they were limited to a letter of only 150 words. That was the maximum. There was a limit. And the letters were censored, both coming in and going out. And Derek Bosson told us that, in fact, one man who was there, a political prisoner, had waited 14 years. They had held a letter for 14 years. That gives you an idea of the lengths of time these people were imprisoned. And all they had done was take certain actions to demonstrate, to try to bring attention to the fact that their country was being run by a white government with a policy of apartheid, which was depriving their people of access to education, to all of their basic rights, and to a say in the running of their country because they weren't allowed to vote in elections. They lived in dire poverty, and a country like South Africa, which has huge resources, a very beautiful country, they weren't having any of the resources of their own country made available to them. And so the man who waited 14 years for the letter that had been censored, Derek Bosson, told us that the letter was from the man's brother, who was just telling him about how a Labour government had got in the United Kingdom under the leadership of Harold Wilson, and that they had beaten the Conservatives with a resounding majority. There was a Labour government in power in London. So that was deemed something that man was not to be allowed to read for 14 years. He then moved with such extraordinary ease to pull up a board, which was a menu. It was just a list of foods, and it was divided down the line, with a line down the centre showing us what the political prisoners, the black prisoners, were given, and what all other prisoners, including the rapists, murderers, people who had done very serious crimes. And it showed their daily rations. And the black prisoners were not allowed any bread. They had a very limited allocation of tiny amount of milk. And on it went. And as you looked at this, you couldn't believe that you could see inside the minds of people who would do this, because, of course, they were trying to weaken them, frustrate them, demean them, humiliate them, and put them into a position where they would no longer have the will to live, not to mention do anything about the plight of their cause to try and bring in democracy and a vote for everybody in South Africa. So the allocation of the food and the basics was highly contested, and Nelson Mandela tried to bring attention to that. And Derek Bosson told us that they actually brought in highly qualified nutritionalists, if you don't mind, white South African, Afrikaner nutritionalists, to justify why the black prisoners, the prisoners who were political prisoners, were not being given bread, and to show that it wasn't part of their natural diet, that they had eaten maize or corn, rough part of the corn, and that that's all they would be given. They weren't allowed any sugar or syrup, and really managed to survive on very, very minimum rations. Of course, what the South African apartheid government was doing at that time was in breach of what we know as the Geneva Conventions. There are conventions agreed as to the basic rights of prisoners, and they were in breach of those when they were doing what they were doing. And so in the group, there were a couple of people from America, me, and a number of schoolgirls, all very colourfully dressed, very nicely dressed, with their teachers, and they were from Zimbabwe, very recognisable by their very elaborate plaited hairdos. And they were on a school trip, and at one stage, when they were down the back of the room, Derek Bosson went to ask them a question and said, I think he was about 18 when he was brought there and hadn't any education, he was illiterate, didn't speak Afrikaans, and they were being forced. The guards would only talk to them in Afrikaans, and they had to very quickly try to understand the language. There was no freedom of religion. They were automatically handed a Bible when they arrived, which seemed like an extraordinary hypocrisy. But unfortunately, at that time, there were groups, Lutheran churches, group of churches that supported apartheid, found ways of justifying it. And he was looking down to the group, and he was trying to get their attention of the schoolgirls. And he said, well, I'd like now to ask the learners their response to this and how it would be for them if they found themselves in this situation. And he referred to them as the learners. I later discovered it's a very popular and much used word to describe students or people that would be studying. And I thought it was a beautiful word. So I adopted it, and I have used it in this book, because I believe that it implies an open-mindedness and a willingness to actually learn. So I came away. We came outside. I was feeling very wobbly. I couldn't speak. It was an extremely emotional experience. And we came out into this little garden where they showed us that some of them from time to time were given the job of doing the garden for the governor of the prison. And they were tending the flowers and the plants there. And they had actually managed to smuggle Nelson Mandela's manuscript in small little pieces, pages at a time. And they used to put them under the flowers. And there was some system where others would then move them. And they were later smuggled off the island between the pages of a photograph album. And that was the way he got information to the outside of the treatment that they were suffering, and also got the word outside to keep people encouraged and to keep the ANC, the African National Congress, still determined to try and win equality and to move in that direction. They also showed us the clothing they were given. They were given shorts of very rough material, no underwear, as I said already, and Nelson Mandela campaigned for proper trousers. The reason, of course, they were dressed like that was because they were looked like boys. And in the way that black people, black men would have been spoken to, would have been in the third person, the boy, you know, the boy who would be the servant or someone to do a job. And so it was another way of demeaning them while they were there. So at that time, when all of that was going on, a very interesting story took place in Dublin and in the south of Ireland, in a big chain of shops called Dunn Stores. One lady decided, called Mary, that she wasn't going to handle the South African oranges, the fruit that was coming in, beautiful fruit that they do provide. And so the Dunn Stores workers had a strike supported by their union. They went out on strike and they said that they wouldn't handle the fruit. They were fired and a strike took place. And for, I think it was 2 years and 9 months, the strike prevailed. The strike ended when only they came off the picket line when the Irish government decided to no longer take in South African goods until the day that apartheid ended. And so this is a story that many people forget about, but those women, there were two men, but mainly women of the group, I think there were 13 of them, went without their wages. They would have been, in many respects, the top wage earner in the house at the time, maybe even the main breadwinner, and they took a stand. Poets like Seamus Heaney gave great support, and a lot of intellectuals and academics supported those workers who eventually had great success. And so you can see the inevitable happened, that in 1990, Nelson Mandela came to visit Dublin, and there was a great reception for him, and he met those women, and he expressed the view to them. You can find this on the TV footage of the time, the news footage of the time. He addressed them looking very emaciated, very, very thin. He was still in a form of detention, but he had come out of Robben Island after 27 years, his health and his back, and you can imagine the state of health being very poor after those kind of rations. But he paid tribute to them, and he said that while they were there in prison, knowing that these workers were walking up and down in a picket outside their place of employment and suffering, the consequences of being without their work was a source of encouragement to him. Interestingly, that whenever we came out to say goodbye to Derek Bosson, he shook our hands as we went out from that garden, which was the last place that he gave us information about. And as we walked out, people were shaking his hand. I'm afraid to admit that I was so emotional I couldn't speak. So the poor man is looking at this extremely strange woman, staring into his face, unable to express anything. We then got onto the coach, and we had a very interesting guide there who brought us, springing us towards the ferry. And then he asked our nationalities. He said, well, how did you find that? I still couldn't get the power of speech without showing my emotions. And I think I got about two or three syllables out of superb. And he said, where are you from? And he asked the people, and they said, America, Zimbabwe. And I said, Ireland. And he said, oh, well, and he told the driver to take a detour. And the driver took a detour to a light little graveyard, little cemetery. And evidently, in days in the long gone past, when Robben Island was used as a leper colony, where they put people with leprosy and contagious diseases, put them out there so they wouldn't infect the civilization on the mainland, they had a number of doctors. They were all missionaries, nurses and doctors who were out there tending the sick. They were in large part of Irish origin, and some of them spent their entire lives there and died there. So he showed us the little cemetery, and he said, would you like to get out and go down? And I think at that stage the emotion was riding so high that I would have just been a withering mass, so I declined. And then this guide looked at me and said, oh yes, we know about Ireland, and we know about the Dunstores workers. It's quite extraordinary. So it is tribute, I suppose, to the small gestures that are taken by people. The Irish anti-apartheid movement was quite a forceful movement. And there is a story behind that also, because there was a South African, Indian South African, I think he was, if I'm correct in saying, called Kader Azmal, who had come to teach in the Trinity Law School. And at that time, he'd come, I think, from a university in England, and he set up the anti-apartheid movement, which was quite vociferous. And then with the support of, if you like, the local workers, like those 13 workers who took that stand, it was quite a force in the landscape here. And he went back after Mandela took power, and when there was, in 1994, free vote and a change in the way that country was run, Kader Azmal returned to South Africa and took up a job he was given, a job in the government at the time. An interesting circular movement, if you like. So the person who was the guide then at that stage mentioned that there were many connections from other countries, of course, where there were anti-apartheid movements. Ireland wasn't the only one. It's just that I can speak from that experience. And the fact that Nelson Mandela came to Ireland in 1990 and made a point of part of his itinerary, meeting those women and the two men and paying tribute to them and expressing his appreciation for that solidarity that had given him so much encouragement. He said in his words that just thinking of them walking up and down, that a labour movement of that nature walking up and down on a picket was extremely encouraging. So this is a little ramble, if you like, into the area of storytelling. And it also, I think, ties in with our discussion about letter writing and about the power of letters and how communications through letters have sustained people who have been separate from their loved ones through imprisonment or off fighting a war or otherwise separated, and how we must never think little of letter writing and, in fact, maybe reconsider it and reevaluate the difference between texting or emailing and actually sitting down, putting pen to paper and expressing oneself. So, in terms of concluding this interesting little journey, I would just say that we hear a lot of news. We listen to the news, we read news. There's a lot of talk about fake news. There's a lot of talk about how far and distant we are from facts and realities. So in this little podcast, this little conversation with you, I have given you a first-hand account, a first-hand story of an experience, which was me touching a little bit of history there in Robben Island off Cape Town in South Africa, and talking again, my link, if you like, back was quite, it had quite an integrity in that I was talking to Derek Bosson, who was himself, had been a prisoner, and was able to give first-hand accounts of the experiences, of the humiliation, of how people, when they are thrown into an environment like that, where to survive, they have to speak somebody else's language, where they have to learn quickly, where they hadn't the benefit of any literacy or any education, and where they depend on people like Nelson Mandela, who kept them going, who kept on campaigning for their rights while in prison and trying to improve their conditions, and who eventually improved their lot as much as he could. He had a huge journey to travel in the short time that he lived after he took power, and of course was the first to say that he hadn't even begun to solve some of the problems that had arisen as a result of so many years of oppression. So it was going to be a long journey back to undo the harm. But you have now had a first-hand experience of my being in Robben Island and hearing those stories from someone who had been on the receiving end of that bad treatment himself, and who seemed to bear absolutely no grudge. He was so impressive. His tone of speech, the way he delivered the information, thoroughly but at the same time impartially, saying, spare a thought for, was one of the expressions he used a lot. Spare a thought for them, meaning that it must at times have been difficult for the guards and for the prison officers to do what they did to them. And that is stretching tolerance and stretching understanding to a degree that I don't think I could ever match, and he certainly did. And then the guide who had the thought to change the direction of the coach going back to the harbour to let me have an opportunity of paying my respects for Irish missionaries who had actually worked looking after sick people, horribly sick people, on what was originally an island where they put people to die because it was no hope of them ever surviving, people who had leprosy and contagious diseases. So there was a lot of mutual respect there and a recognition of what had been done. So I would just say in leaving about very interesting experience that I had one day walking in a beautiful part of South Africa called the Kirstenbosch Gardens. And as we passed on the bus to go to this place, this beautiful, beautiful botanical gardens in a lovely setting, we passed a township. And as the person who was giving the commentary on the red bus for the tourists said, we're passing now an area here where there are people who have stables and horse boxes for their beautiful ponies that are actually bigger than the spaces that the people we'll see shortly have to live in. And as the bus drove up, on the right of what looked like a slope or a slant on a roundabout, slight elevation of the land, there were just some corrugated sheets. And it was beyond one's comprehension to think that families actually considered that township a place to live, but they did, and they do. And in that Kirstenbosch Gardens, there was a lovely board sitting up beside the entrance to the conservatory. And on that it had beautiful writing. And it's an old Namibian saying, do not dismiss the talk of older people. They were first to see the sun. So I leave you with that. So sometimes what people senior to us have to say is worth listening to, because as the essence of that saying conveys, they were first to see the sun. Thank you.